Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. For podcasts of this show and all others, you can go to the Earth Matters page on the Gila Members Community Radio website. I'm Donna Stevens, and I'm your host for today's show, and I'm the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, which is a local nonprofit working to protect the Gila watershed through advocacy, education, and restoration. Joining me here in the studio is my guest Madeline Carey, and her title is the Greater Gila Guardian for Wild Earth Guardians based in Santa Fe. We're going to be talking today about threats to wildlife, public lands grazing, the beef industry, and more. Welcome, Madeline.
Thanks, Donna. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you were here a couple years ago. I don't remember when, but it's been a while, so I'm glad to welcome you back. I wanted to start today's show by talking about one of Wild Earth Guardians' campaigns, which is ending the war on wildlife. So this campaign targets a little-known government agency called Wildlife Services, which is really quite a euphemism. They changed their name from Animal Damage Control several years ago because of bad publicity. Madeline, can you talk about what Wildlife Services actually does?
Sure, and I'll do my best to define acronyms as we go, but stop okay. me if I throw out one, because there's a lot when we're dealing
yes.
with federal agencies.
Right.
So Wildlife Services is a program under the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or the USDA. It's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, and APHIS is designed to provide federal leadership in managing problems caused by wildlife. The program's mission statement provides much insight into the manner in which Wildlife Services has long viewed its responsibilities, that wildlife is a problem. Many of the problems the program claims to address are not caused by wildlife, nor are they remedied by the tools employed by Wildlife Services. So Wildlife Services does anything from or APHIS does anything from if you're flying home from Hawaii or into California or into the U.S., you usually go through an agricultural inspection station.
Mm-hmm.
So APHIS will deal with preventing invasive species or controlling invasive species coming into the U.S. through agricultural products. And Wildlife Services basically carries out eradication and suppression and control activities on wildlife, everything from rats and starlings to wolves and cougars. And they have a whole host of non-lethal management tools they could be using to do this, but more often than not, they're using lethal management tools such as aerial gunning, traps, and poisons to eliminate what are perceived as problem wildlife. And more often than not, they're sort of putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. It's the best way to explain it is if you have a pack of coyotes that's causing problems or is perceived to be causing problems, lethally removing them from the wild just creates an open niche and an open territory for a new coyote pack to move into.
Right.
And so it sort of creates its own industrial complex where by doing its work, it only creates more work for itself.
Job security.
Exactly.
Right. Can you share with our listeners some of the species and the numbers of animals that are killed by Wildlife Services?
Sure. So in the past 10 years, Wildlife Services has spent over $1 billion to kill 37 million animals. And these animals range from, like I said, starlings and songbirds that are considered pests for row crops or agricultural crops, to wolves, cougars, bears, coyotes, badgers, the native carnivores of the American West. And to give you numbers for the past sort of 5 years, in 2010, 5 million animals total were killed. In 2011, 3.7 million. 2012, 3.3 million. 1.5 million of those were native animals. In 2013, 4.3 million were killed, 2 million of which were native animals. In 2015, which is the last year that statistics are publicly available for, they killed a total of 3.2 million animals, 1.6 of which were native, 1.5 were non-native or invasive species.
So these species, I mean, when they go out and kill them, they don't have to have a permit, even though they could be game animals, say, like mountain lions or bears? I mean, most people have to have a permit or you have to kill them in season, but does Wildlife Services do that?
So they function as a federal agency and they operate under which we'll get to in a little bit because it's called a PEIS, which is a programmatic environmental impact statement. That's decades old, and it's something that guardians and our allies have worked on for many years to get them to update that and use new science to look at what they do. But that document basically gives them carte blanche to carry out their mission across the American West and the rest of the country, too, although a large portion of their predator work happens in the 11 Western states.
Right. What industries benefit from Wildlife Service's killing of these animals? I mean, who are they pests to?
Well, certainly not to the vast majority of Americans who appreciate wildlife and, and those who live in cities and often travel to the West to see wildlife. Wildlife Services primarily is working to benefit a handful of agricultural and livestock interests. The program responds to calls from farmers and ranchers who've often refused to implement non-lethal and common sense strategies to effectively coexist with native carnivores and other wildlife. It's a lot easier to sort of call up your local federal trapper exterminator and say, hey, I have a lion problem, than it is to really shift the ethic in which you manage your livestock or your cattle.
Right. Yeah. So how does Wildlife Services get its funding? You said they are a federal agency. Are they? Is it all federal money?
Yes. Wildlife Services responds to its requests for its animal damage control services from individuals, businesses, organizations, and local and state governments, as well as other federal agencies, such as the Department of Defense or the Bureau of Reclamation, and those referred to as cooperators. And the program operates on a budget that's funded by a combination of congressional appropriations and cooperator reimbursements. For example, in 2014, the last year currently disclosed, Wildlife Services budget was $127,663,000, of which $66 million came directly from congressional appropriations and other funding sources, and $60 million came in the form of reimbursement from the individuals or entities. So counties like Grant County, and Grant County actually has a contract with Wildlife Services, has a year-to-year contract, or they might be longer-term contracts that basically say, we'd like to hire you to be at our beck and call to deal with these issues. And those contracts are negotiated, and the county will use taxpayer funds to pay cooperator reimbursements to Wildlife Services for their services, not to wildlife.
Right. So I don't think that's very well known to the general public that our tax dollars are being used to kill wildlife who, you know, like you said earlier, who most people appreciate and that aren't bothering the vast majority of us.
Yeah, that's been one of the big issues. You mentioned how Wildlife Services changed its name. It was in 1997. They used to be called Animal Damage Control. And as you might imagine, they were suffering a pretty bad publicity problem from that name. And that is one of the many ways in which the agency and program have been deceitful and really worked very hard to keep the public from knowing about what they do. And we have FOIA'd and had to file lawsuits. And
FOIA, there you go. There's an acronym.
Freedom of Information Act. And it's basically a piece of legislation that says you as a citizen have a right to know what your government's doing with your tax dollars. And it's a really cool piece of legislation because it enables us to find out if I want to know the ins and outs of what's going on a public lands ranching permit, I can file a FOIA request to the Gila National Forest to get everything that's ever been written about that permit or written to the file of that permit. And that's how Guardians got a lot of our information on Wildlife Services. And a lot of our early work was just getting those numbers of how many animals and of what kind were killed and really forcing the agency to become more accountable to the public. And for a long time, that was the only work we were really able to do, is get in this protracted legal battle with them about daylighting their work and how they do it. Because like what you said, a lot of Americans are unaware that there's this agency that operates this way and is killing millions of wild animals every year.
Yeah. So it's my understanding that Wildlife Services traps and poisons wildlife, but they also unintentionally kill other animals as well, including, say, family pets. Can you talk about incidental kill, or what do we call it in war? What is that?
Collateral damage.
Right, collateral damage.
Yeah, so in fishing, we'd call it bycatch. With trapping, right? It's called catching non-target species. But as you might imagine, indiscriminate methods of killing, such as traps or poisons that are just set out on public lands, often harm and kill non-target species, mm-hmm. Or cause collateral damage. The most recent story that had major headlines is the story of a young boy who was seriously injured and his dog was killed in eastern Idaho when they came across an M44 or cyanide device in eastern Idaho that was set by an APHIS or Wildlife Services employee. Mm-hmm. And basically, those devices are designed to inject cyanide into the mouth of a predator, and it has an attractant. So when they bite down on it, the animal's instantly poisoned with cyanide. The dog came across it and was killed in the young boy was very seriously injured and is fortunately still alive. And that generated a lot of discussion and enabled us to gain more traction on our work on wildlife services in Idaho, because if you talk to the agencies or you talk to people who utilize the services offered, they say, oh, they're very careful. They're professionals. They know exactly how they're doing their job. And this is not to diminish any one employee of Wildlife mm-hmm. Services, but I think it's fair to make a blanket statement that they're not acting with the public welfare in mind, which is actually part of their mission. They claim that some of these animals pose a threat to public safety and welfare, and in reality, the agency is actually creating a threat by setting out these devices. And trapping and traps they set can be another big issue. Most states have really strictly regulated trapping. New Mexico has actually some of the looser trapping laws in the American West.
Okay.
But generally, there's rules about how far traps have to be from roads and trails, how they have to be marked, how you can use scents or attractants to get animals to walk into them. And there's, you know, half a dozen at least dogs every year that step in traps in New Mexico, most of which are set by recreational trappers. But there have been instances of across the West of traps set by the federal government that catch people's dogs. This poses a huge safety threat to have these out on public land, especially when the public, A, doesn't know about the agency, B, doesn't know what methods it uses. It's one thing to say, I'm out in rattlesnake country, I'm going to be careful to listen for rattlesnakes. But you don't, you know, I don't know what an M44 device looks like on public lands, and I don't know where it's likely to be set. And there's no warnings. There's no signs up at trailheads that say, you know, there are these devices set in this area. Please keep your dogs on leash.
That's what I was going to ask you. They don't have to provide any kind of warning.
No, that mm-hmm. they're doing it. And, you know, it operates under this blanket assumption that recreational users of public lands are only on really well-marked and designated trails, and that livestock users have carte blanche to use the rest of the public lands as they see fit or as they can within the how the agency manages for them. And, you know, just this weekend, I got lost on my mountain bike and spent an hour marching around off trail where, had there been a trap set, I likely would have stepped in it. And mm-hmm. it's not illegal for me to be doing that. I was well within my rights as a public lands user, albeit I was very, very lost and not where right. I wanted to be.
That's not illegal.
Yeah, but it's not illegal to get lost, fortunately.
Well, if we have time at the end of the show, we'll come back to the public lands trapping issue. But for right now, we need to take a short break, so please stay with us. I'll continue my discussion about wildlife, habitat, grazing with Madeline Carey. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and I'm talking with Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians. We're talking about wildlife, grazings, and we'll get to some other public lands issues later in the show. Right before the break, we were talking about a federal agency called Wildlife Services, which, as we said, is really quite a euphemism, because their mission is to kill animals, which isn't much of a service, depending on your perspective. So I wanted to ask you, Madeline, what is the goal of Wild Earth Guardians? Like, what would you guys like to see happen, you know, in terms of wildlife services?
Well, in short, we'd like to see them promoting, supporting, and providing only non-lethal tactics, as well as seeing increased transparency around their practices. We've had to file lawsuits to get the agency to disclose just how it spends taxpayer dollars. We negotiated a big settlement this past fall. In August 2015, the Ninth Circuit Court held that the program's reliance on a 20-year-old analysis, which itself relies on outdated and largely disproven decades of old science, was not immune from environmental review. And the settlement that we negotiated requires the program to no longer rely on the 22-year-old programmatic environmental impact statement, the PEIS I referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. And so they'll have to conduct a new environmental analysis of its activities in Nevada, where this case was filed.
Just for that one state?
Just for that one state, but it will also update all the analyses nationwide that rely on that same PEIS from 1994.
Okay.
And part of this settlement also means that it will, Wildlife Services will cease killing in all designated wilderness areas and wilderness study areas in Nevada, which is over 6 million acres of public land. And so to dive a little deeper into what we would really like to see from the agency is Wildlife Services needs to solve the root of the problem it continually sets out to remedy, which is native wildlife conflicts with private domestic livestock grazing on our nation's public lands. And the program should adopt a policy advocating for active and permanent voluntary retirement of grazing permits for allotments on public lands. Would also like to see Wildlife Services be removed from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and transferred to the U.S. Department of the Interior. A fundamental conflict of interest presides over the program services when its actions are driven by an agency beholden to protecting the nation's agricultural interests. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's an affront to the Department of Interior's mission to protect and conserve our public lands. We'd also like to see them prioritize conservation of imperiled species in their habitats. The program needs to deploy the best available science to maintain necessary biodiversity and critical habitat at all costs, which would mean in addition to ending all lethal control on public lands, the program would need to end its use of indiscriminate lethal control devices like that M44 device we talked about.
Right.
Because, you know, they could put up a sign that says, if you're an endangered species, don't bite this.
Yeah.
But animals don't read and bombs don't know what species are endangered. And then fundamentally, we'd like to see them end their lethal control activities on public lands. Public lands belong to all of us, and our public tax dollars should not be spent at the behest of a minority of special interests that are hostile to native carnivores. The majority of Americans would really like to see grizzly bears, black bear, wolves return to their cougars, lynx, bobcat, badgers, you name it, out on their public lands, living wild lives and existing in ecologically effective populations. And Wildlife Services is not respecting that majority wish or honoring that directive.
So let me ask you a question. Can a rancher, say, call up Wildlife Services and just say, there's this, I don't know, bear, wolf, whatever it is, bothering my calves, or, and then Wildlife Services comes out and gets rid of that animal, and they don't have to pay for that service, or do they have to pay?
It depends on how the contracts are set up, and there's a little bit more paperwork than just picking up the phone. But generally, yes, I'm not exactly sure about the specifics of how each individual transaction works, and I think it depends a lot on what county and municipality contracts are held as to how that functions.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a pretty good deal for people who are grazing public lands.
It's one of the many ways in which we talk about public lands ranching being subsidized.
Yes.
It's basically there's a whole host of federal programs and tax incentives and prices that are held artificially low through sort of market fixing that make public lands grazing feel like it's economically viable. And if public lands ranchers were paying market rate for all the services they receive for and benefits they receive from the government, no one would be doing it because it's already a hard go of it as it is with all the government help.
Right. Well, that's a good segue into our next topic, which really is grazing cattle on public lands. And I wanted to ask first, before we get into the specifics, what are some of the negative impacts to the land from grazing?
Well, there are a lot. And the main blanket one is that historically, public lands grazing has caused native species of both plants and animals to go extinct. And, you know, it's not like cows are out there killing grizzly bears and eating them for dinner. But the people who own the cows have spent the past 100 years eliminating most of the native carnivores from the Western United States, and that's why we have reintroduction efforts and recovery efforts for both the grizzly bear and for wolves across the West. Some specific impacts are cattle tend to eat grass. I'm forgetting the exact range term for this, but they're selective grazers. And so they don't mow an area evenly, and they will eat the grass they have a higher preference for. And so you get species imbalances, which can cause nutrient imbalances in the soil and lead the soil to not be able to support the natural biodiversity of grasses you would have there. And you would also tend to see cattle prefer, like any sensible creature would, sort of sweeter and better tasting grasses, and they tend to not like to eat weeds, and they're not browsers. And so when you have a range that's inhabited by a grazing dominant ungulate like cattle, as opposed to goats that would eat brush or deer that are browsers and tend to eat more of brush and shrubs, you start to see an ecological imbalance, and there's whole trickle-down effects of that. Another impact that's particularly bad in the desert Southwest is their impact on riparian areas. When it's hot and dry out, cattle, like humans and other wildlife, congregate around water sources, and they will eat back all of the vegetation on the banks, which removes shade, which is really important to keeping cold water fisheries viable for trout species. And so we've seen this sort of cascading effect across the West, is as you have areas actively grazed and there's riparian impacts, you see streams coming out of compliance for temperature, and they're getting too hot for fish to really survive because there's no shade to help cool the water. That also increases erosion, which adds more sediment into the watershed. And if you think about it in a macro sense, if all these little streams up way high above the watershed are bringing in a little bit more sediment, a little bit more sediment each of the way down, the net impact of that is having a river system that's heavily sedimented and has a negative impacts for any flood control infrastructure that exists downstream, but B, has negative impacts for all the native species dependent on it. And on top of that, the cows tend to poop in the water, and cow poop, like other kinds of poop, carries a lot of bacteria. And that's one reason why it's really dangerous to drink, or can be very dangerous to drink stream water when you're out on public lands, is you don't have no way of knowing if there's 50 cows upstream from you that are introducing E. coli into the water. And it's easy to get very, very sick from just a single drop of water that's contaminated with cow poop.
Yeah, and also cattle eat the young vegetation that's emerging. So there's many streams, say, in the Gila National Forest that have old cottonwoods but no young ones because they're all just getting eaten by cattle.
Exactly. And, you know, to talk about another environmental impact, Wildlife Services is an environmental impact of public lands cattle ranching. That whole agency grew out of the open range era and the need to control, or the perceived need to control, predators through lethal tactics. And so at Guardians, when we talk about the hows and whys of our work, a lot of it hinges around the impacts of having cattle out on public lands and how much taxpayer money is spent to prop up that industry and make it easier for them to exist, despite the fact that many Americans would prefer that the money was spent actually conserving wildlife.
It makes me kind of wish that the profession that I'm in had some really great federal subsidies.
I know.
But alas, conservationists don't get those. So you've talked a little bit about why working on this issue of public lands grazing is important to Wild Earth Guardians. And I wanted to ask you specifically about an issue that you work on that not very many people are working on, which is voluntary grazing permit buyouts and retirement. Can you first say what that means and then talk about it a little bit?
Absolutely. And this is my favorite. And in full disclosure, I don't actually do much of our Wildlife Services work. That's my coworker, Michelle, who mainly works on that. And so now I'm excited to talk about what I really work on, which is permit retirement. And so to back up and do a 30-second overview of what public lands ranching is most of our public lands across the West, the majority of them, are broken up. So think about your nearby national forest, your BLM area. National parks are excluded from this, but wilderness areas are not. They're broken up into smaller areas that range from 5,000 to 50,000 acres in size that are called grazing allotments. And each of those allotments is leased to a permittee who's a member of the public with what's called a permit, a grazing permit. And those are administered at the local ranger district level. And although there is a range in grazing position at, as you go up the food chain all the way to the Washington office. So each rancher has to have some private land in the area in order to be eligible to receive one of these leases, but they pay a super discounted rate compared to what it would cost them to lease a state land or private pasture land. The current grazing fee is, I believe, $1.83, and it went up this year for the first time in a few years. The state grazing fee in New Mexico is about $13 per animal unit month, which is how much grass it takes to feed a mother cow and calf for 1 month, how many pounds of forage is produced.
That's quite a difference.
Yeah, and there are places in the U.S. where it's $200 per AUM, and private lands pasture rates are often much higher. So grazing permit retirement is not a new idea. It's been around for a while. It was used on the 6 forests that surround Yellowstone National Park to resolve ongoing conflicts between the sheep industry and the grizzly bears. And I think the funniest sentence I've ever read is in a Forest Service document that says, our studies concluded that sheep grazing and grizzly bear habitat are incompatible land uses, which you would think no one really needed to do a study to think about if those are things that can happen on the same acre of land.
Yes.
And so what grazing permit retirement is it's a three-way deal between conservation investors, the Forest Service, or BLM, so the Managing Federal Land Agency, and the rancher. And the conservation investors, that deal is usually brokered by a nonprofit like Guardians. We negotiate a price for the rancher's permit, which is comparable to what they would receive in the private market if they were going to sell it to a neighboring rancher. And we pay the rancher to waive their permit back to the Forest Service. And then that permit is usually temporarily closed through what's called an administrative closure until they can do a new NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, a new analysis to look at the suitability of that area for grazing. In other areas of the country, there's congressionally acted buyout legislation that basically says, and it's usually in conjunction with land designation. So for the 250,000-acre Boulder White Clouds Wilderness that was designated last year, there were 700,000 acres of buyout that were authorized around, in and around that wilderness area. And those make the closures and waivers of permits permanent, because a final land use decision has to happen at the congressional level. And so right now on the Gila, we're working with administrative closures, but at the same time lobbying to get some federal legislation that would be focused on providing relief for the Mexican wolf recovery effort, because the majority of that opposition has come from the public lands ranching industry.
Yeah, we need to take a short break here, and we'll talk about this some more because there's still a lot more to say about this. So please don't go away. I'm talking with Madeline Carey about voluntary grazing permit buyouts. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and I'm talking with Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians. Before the break, we were talking about voluntary grazing permit buyouts and retirement, and you were explaining a little bit how that works, Madeline. Do you have anything else you needed to add about that? Or
I would just say the important part to understand is that it can happen in two ways. One is the administrative closure through the Forest Service, which isn't a guaranteed closure to grazing, and then the legislative avenue where you have a piece of legislation that's been congressionally enacted that makes those closures permanent. The second thing would be that it's a free market system. We're not forcing these ranchers to do it. No one's telling them they have to. We're trying to put it on the table as an option. And a lot of these ranchers see it as a retirement option. If their kids don't want to buy the permit, their permit's been badly burned in wildfire, if they have conflict with listed endangered species or threatened endangered species. Or a lot of these guys, the permit has been in their family for four generations, and they don't want to see anyone else out ranching that land. And so it's a way for them to realize the monetary value in what we feel is like a pretty economically just way, at the same time accomplishing some conservation goals.
You're saying that though, for those voluntary buyouts, that those could be, they'll be reviewed, and they could be grazed again. Is there a certain time that they get rested for, a certain number of years?
It totally depends somewhat on how we are able to negotiate with the Forest Service and how individual districts operate. And that's why we'd greatly prefer to have legislation enacted at the federal level. And it's something that I'm working on with both of the New Mexico senators, as well as other lawmakers from around the West right now, to find a good vehicle for that. Because there's a lot of interest in Washington, and there's a lot of interesting individuals in Washington that have backgrounds in cattle that really see it as a way for ranchers to escape financial burden. Because for a lot of these guys, their back's up against the wall. It's a hard way to make a living, and this can either pay off debt or offer them the opportunity to invest in a new business venture.
And they still get to stay on their land and hang out in a cool place. They just don't have to work hard anymore.
Exactly.
Right?
They
so
don't
it's kind
have
of a win-win.
Exactly. And there's a lot of opposition that comes from the cattle industry because they see it as an attack on public lands ranching from the environmental community. Mm-hmm. And it's really us trying to put in place a mechanism that should exist within the Forest Service anyways. There's no reason for 90% of the public lands in the American West to be permitted for ranching, cattle ranching. That number might be a little high. That's the Gila National Forest.
Okay. Well, it's very high, and a lot of these places aren't suitable for grazing. As you can see when you're out there, there's nothing to eat here.
Or it's the side of a mountain. Some of these allotments I go out on, I just, you know, I grew up with horses, and we kept them on a very flat, well-fenced, you know, treeless with a run-in shed irrigated pasture. And I go out on some of these allotments in the Gila, and it looks like a ski area.
Right.
You know, there's aspen trees, and it's a 30-degree slope. And I just can't imagine that being an effective or easy way to raise animals at pasture.
Right. And so I just wanted to go back to one thing you said about the congressional closures. Are those closures for specific grazing allotments only?
Yes. And so the legislation we're pursuing would authorize a certain number of these retirements per year in states. And there was actually some legislation introduced in 2013 that never made it through the final bill in 2014, but it would have authorized 25 closures a year in New Mexico and in Oregon, which are where you have senators that believe in how this system works, but you also have public land ranchers asking to have this mechanism in place.
Okay. So there would be a limited number of permanent retirements.
That's how we would do it. And I mean, if we had the federal legislation and I had all the money in the world to execute these agreements, I don't think I could find 25 ranchers a year in New Mexico because it's a really hard decision for them to get out of ranching.
Yeah.
But there is enough interest that we really need that legislation because a lot of our conservation investors don't want to invest in these buyouts unless they know it's going to be permanently closed to grazing.
Sure. Yeah. So that brings us to back home here to the Gila National Forest. Have you had any Gila National Forest ranchers retire their grazing permits?
So we've executed one and are in negotiations with several others, which I'm not able to talk about publicly, but I am able to talk about the one we did, which is the Deep Creek allotment up near Glenwood, New Mexico. It's what the Forest Service has told me they call a vertical allotment. It has about 5,000 feet of relief across it, and there's no road that goes from the bottom of it near a highway up to the top. You have to drive all the way around through reserve to get there, for those of you familiar with the area. It burned really badly in the Whitewater Baldy Fire. A lot of the infrastructure, so meaning the fences and I think some water improvements, burned in that fire. And there's also been denning wolves on it pretty consistently for the past decade. The Dark Canyon Pack most frequently has had pups there, which I actually heard last summer, which was exciting.
Nice.
And there were just a lot of consistent issues. And the rancher was older. He was in his 70s, and it was the amount of money it was going to take him to get the allotment back up and running after the fire, coupled with the having to manage for wolves, coupled with it being a difficult allotment, made it the right choice for him. And that's one that we think that when the Forest Service gets around to doing their next suitability analysis and after 2020, they'll probably find it unsuitable for grazing just because it's so hard to make money doing it. And it's just, I mean, you could not pick a worse way to set up an allotment with a, you know, big escarpment in the middle.
Yeah.
And then the other ones, I probably am in any one time in contact with 6 to 12 ranchers, both on the Gila National Forest and the Apache Sitgraves. some of them call me up, and everyone knows we're offering this deal. Once we did the first deal and that went public, everyone knows it, and it's just people getting to the place where they feel like it's the right option. People frequently call and want us to buy whole ranches, which is not something we do. We don't work as a land trust, and there are other groups that have done that. The Grand Canyon Trust did it with the North Rim Ranches, where they bought up whole operations. But that is a lot more capital and time and paperwork than we're looking to get into, and we really feel like permit retirement is much more simple and elegant and better all the way around for people because it's letting ranchers stay on their base properties.
So I wanted to ask you about the compensation piece a little bit. So you touched on this earlier. So what you offered the rancher, say, at the Deep Creek allotment was what he would have received if he had sold his grazing permit on the open market?
It's similar. And depending on the resources on the allotment, which for us is denning wolves, the Continental Divide Trail, so recreation resources, a little bit if it's in a really high-end elk hunting unit like 16A or 16D game management unit, we're able to pay a little bit more. And each negotiation is really different because we paid a little bit of a premium on the Deep Creek one just because it was our first one, and the rancher took a lot of grief in his local community for being the first guy to stick his neck out.
A lot of peer pressure there.
And yeah, a lot of peer pressure. And we were willing to do that. But, we have ranchers who call and say, if you can match this price, I'll do it. And sometimes we say, that's way too high. If you want to negotiate, we're happy to. And they say no, and they hang up the phone. Other times they call us with a price that's sort of, you know, very, very reasonable. And we're instantly able to say, like, yeah, let's get going on an outline. Let's get in and talk to the Forest Service and see if we can make this worth it. And some of them are very long negotiations, that have been going on for a year or more to really figure out how to cobble together a payment package that works for them. And sometimes if we feel like the price is too high and we don't want to pay a lump sum, we will offer some compensation in exchange for them, their continued engagement over the years in trying to get federal legislation passed. Because it's one thing for me to show up in D.C. in a, business suit with my biology degree and say, this is really important, we need this. And it's a whole other thing for me to show up with three ranchers in tow and their cowboy boots and hats and buckles. And they have to say their one thing for us, and then we let them anything else they want to talk to the senators about,
right,
they can say. But they're a much more effective messenger than an environmentalist is.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the trend in the last 20 years or so. I just sort of picked the number 20, about family-owned ranches in the Gila. What's going on there?
So in the greater Gila bioregion, which includes both the Gila National Forest and the Apache Sitgraves National Forest in Arizona, over 50% of the grazing allotments have changed hands in the past 10 years, which means it's not like father giving it to son. It's completely changing ownership and completely changing who has it. And that's a trend you're seeing across the West. Both it's getting harder and harder and harder because of economies of scale and other global beef issues we'll talk about later, for individual ranchers to make a living doing it. And you also don't see a lot of kids wanting to get into ranching. There's a big trend of people wanting to either live in cities and have jobs that are more urban-centric or have other jobs, whether it's with the Forest Service working as a biologist or a range con, or whether it's working on fire or becoming a veterinarian. There's just an attraction towards a different type of jobs than there used to be, and I think the economic future doesn't look as bright. So generally, we're seeing a trend where we're getting a lot of what we would call hobby ranchers who are coming in who have money from retirement or other investments or are independently wealthy through family money or a business venture. And they're buying up ranches and sort of playing cowboy. They don't really need to make money running cattle. So, in one way, it's great because if a wolf eats a few of their calves, they're less mad because it's not coming out of their bottom line. They have some money to cover that gap. But it's also, making a hobby and a sport out of public lands ranching, which has these wide-ranging economic, ecological impacts. And we really would not like to see that happening. And a lot of them are just sort of living the cowboy life. They wake up in the morning and go out with their rifle and look for elk and deer, and then they come back and have breakfast, and then they get on their horse and they ride around and look at their cows and call it a day. That's
sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, I know. It's the dream. But it's not, you know, economically productive ranching. There's very, very few people that are raising cattle on a Gila National Forest permit, having it slaughtered within the state, and sending it to market within the state. Most of the permits are feeding into this, and permittees and ranching operations are feeding into this much larger industrial agricultural complex. So the whole image of your steak coming from a cow that was herded down out of the mountains by a cowboy is of pure fantasy.
Yes. Well, we like fantasies here in this country. So that's a good stopping point. We need to take a short break here. And please stay with us. I'm talking with Madeline Carey, and right after the break, we are going to talk about global beef. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and I am talking with Madeline Carey of Wild Earth Guardians. Before the break, Madeline, we were talking about public lands grazing, voluntary grazing permit retirements, and I wanted to stay on the topic of cattle but broaden it to a much larger global scale. So specifically, I want to talk with you about a global company called JBS Meat Packers. As it turns out, they're the world's largest meat producer, and they started in Brazil. I'll have to admit, I had never heard of them until you told me about them. And when I did some online research, I saw that a reporter called JBS the world's largest food company that you've probably never heard of. So in the last 10 or 12 years, they've moved into the United States after they acquired two large meat producers, Swift & Company and Smithfield. Can you tell us a little bit about JBS?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll start by saying I'm an environmental activist and not a global agricultural economist, but here's what I know. I got into the work I do because I love wolves, and I was excited about returning wolves to the American West, and I probably know less about wolves now than when I started my job and way more about the global beef industry than I ever imagined I would learn or want to know.
Right.
So JBS is a Brazilian-based company that owns substantial U.S. assets. By sales, it's the largest meat processing company in the entire world. It was founded in 1953. It has over 150 industrial meatpacking plants around the globe. In the mid-double aughts is when it really sort of rose to global prominence. It became a publicly traded company in Brazil in 2007 and received its first major investment from the Brazilian Development Bank, which is important because there was a big recent fallout and corruption scandal involving JBS paying off some Brazilian government officials. And it really highlighted how incestuous the relationship between government and industrial agriculture in Brazil has become.
Mm-hmm.
Also in 2007, as you said, JBS acquired Swift & Company, which is the U.S.'s third largest beef and pork processor. In the following years, JBS has acquired portions and sometimes the entire company, both Cargill Incorporated and Tyson Foods Incorporated. All in all, it's not only a massive player in the national and international meat market, it is the player. And in 2017, it was estimated that JBS and JBS-owned companies was the second largest processor of beef, pork, and poultry in the U.S.
It's amazing that I never heard of them. Maybe I'm just ignorant, but I don't know about our listeners, if they've heard or not.
I don't think you're ignorant. I wouldn't say that if anyone hasn't heard of JBS. It's part of industrial ag that really wants to frame your meat as coming from the little picturesque farm on the label when you pick up your pork chops out of the meat cooler at work, and really insulate you from this massive industrial process, which has come to be how we raise most of our animal products that we consume.
So JBS was involved in this big scandal a few months ago. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It was a multifaceted scandal. So in March of this year, JBS was accused by Brazil's environmental regulator of buying cattle raised on illegally deforested Amazon land. Obviously, JBS denied this. Also in March, it was announced that Brazil was investigating the meatpacking industry for allegedly bribing food sanitation inspectors. And JBS SA South America was among the dozens of firms targeted. In particular, there was a single employee targeted. With that announcement, JBS shares dropped 10%. Some of these bribes involved bribing inspectors to overlook the international shipment of rotten and spoiled meat. And this actually triggered a massive global embargo against importing Brazilian beef yeah, the announcement of the police allegations led to various nations considering banning Brazilian beef imports. China, 20 other countries in the EU subsequently issued bans. The U.S. also issued a ban. And the statistic was usually the U.S. turns away about 1% of imports from any given country, and they were frequently turning away up to 10% of the imports from Brazil. They were finding things such as blood clots, lymph nodes, and abscesses that stem from the reaction to components of the foot and mouth disease vaccine. So really nasty stuff, and beef that was not only allowed to leave Brazil, but was also being imported by other countries. The fallout from this has basically been, and there's an additional investigation as to whether JBS had received illegal financing from the state-owned bank. And finally, the controlling shareholder agreed to pay a $3.2 billion fine for its role in these corruption scandals. And it's, you know, if you go down the rabbit hole on the internet of looking at this stuff, it's, you know, the only thing I could compare it to in the U.S. is, you know, having Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, but 10 times worse. You know, Rex Tillerson used to run this massive oil company and obviously still has very close ties to those decision makers, and that's probably guiding some of his interpretation of U.S. foreign policy. And that was happening on a much, much larger scale at way more levels of government in U.S., but in reference to how they raise, process, and sell beef.
Well, let's talk about another global player here, and that's China, the U.S. and China. So we used to export beef to China, and then we stopped for a long time, and that was because of mad cow disease. And I understand that it either just happened or is just about to happen that exports are going to resume from the U.S. to China. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So it's important to frame this in the context of the U.S.-China trade deficit, in which the U.S. imports more goods from China than it's able to sell to China. And so the recent negotiations are part of President Trump's entire trade negotiations with China that included us being able to sell natural gas to China, which had not been happening in a long time. So in 2003, China and many other countries around the world halted imports because of mad cow disease. And that's not uncommon for there to be trade embargoes or temporarily trade freezes when there's an outbreak of a disease. For example, is we stopped importing Chinese chicken in 2015 due to the avian flu. And that's another part of this trade deal is we'll begin selling beef to China, but we have to start buying cooked chicken from them. So we're not importing live chickens, it's cooked chicken. Mm-hmm. So I'm imagining it's like the kind of chicken you get when you order a Caesar salad from McDonald's that comes in like a little package and it's been frozen for God knows how many months,
right,
or years. So some other facts about that. It opens up a $2.5 billion market for U.S. beef. That sounds like a huge amount of money. In reality, it's 0.01% of the U.S. economy, and it's 0.5% of the bilateral trade deficit. So there's been a lot of fanfare coming from the agricultural community about how it's this massive $2.5 billion deal. And the crazy thing about the current global economy is that that's a drop in the bucket, if that. It's half a drop. One of the issues that's come up with this deal is the U.S. doesn't have a mandatory cattle ID program, which means there's no way for you as a consumer, it's not mandated by the federal government that there be a label on your meat that says this was cow 375 that came from farm number 32 in Illinois, and he was killed on this date. There's no mandatory labeling system. There's a voluntary one. And that was part of this negotiation. An estimate I've seen is that about 15% of U.S. cattle are age and source verified. And so China's going to have to accept that unless they're able to force us to implement a mandatory ID system, which seems unlikely.
And don't they also mix together all the beef so that you aren't just getting, when you get a package of beef, it isn't just one cow, right?
Yes, and there's been, that issue has sparked a big issue in the U.S., which is about country of origin labeling. Because U.S. beef has this, it's like French wine, and that's one of the reasons why we're interested in importing to China is the way You know, you can get $5 bottles of red wine that's grown from grapes on a big industrial vineyard somewhere in the mm-hmm. Central Valley of California. You can also buy a $50 bottle of wine. And if you're really into wine, you notice a difference. Mm-hmm. If you're not really into wine, you're sort of like, whatever, I'll buy the $5 bottle of wine right. from the U.S. And it's a similar thing with beef. We think French wine has this cultural connotation and U.S. beef has the same thing worldwide. And our main competitor in the Chinese market is Australia. And Australia has a really massive industrial beef operation as well. And so the where beef comes from and whether it's labeled as being from there is really, really important to all countries dealing with trade negotiations, but in particular to the U.S. because we tend to carry a higher market value for our beef because it's raised by a cowboy on the open range.
Right, even if it isn't.
Even if it isn't.
What about the ecological significance of us sending U.S. grown and produced beef halfway around the world?
That gets into sort of the environmental impacts of any kind of global trade. The easiest thing to draw a parallel with is something else Guardians works on, which is the federal coal leasing program, where coal that's on federal public lands that in theory is owned by the American public is leased at a very low rate to U.S. companies to mine, excavate, and then ship overseas because there really is not a good market for coal for energy production in the U.S. It's really the two largest coal companies in the U.S. filed for bankruptcy last year, and it's really it's just too expensive and costly to do that. We've had a surplus of natural gas, and more than any environmental impact, that shift in a surplus of natural gas has really devalued coal. And it gets into this, you know, we know coal causes, we know burning coal causes climate change. We know industrial agriculture causes climate change, or they both contribute to climate change. And so is it right for us, especially in context of backing out of the Paris Accord, is it, you know, fiscally pragmatic, socially pragmatic for us to be essentially exporting our environmental problems? That, you know, beef consumption in the U.S. has actually declined dramatically since 1950. Meatless Mondays is part of that, as well as sort of popular science about the impacts of consuming, in particular, red meat in high quantities and how it can lead to coronary disease. And it's seen as sort of the rising middle class in China. It's seen as a sign of affluence to consume meat. Mm-hmm. And it's not impossible to envision a world where 80% of the cattle or 85% of the cattle raised in the U.S. are exported to other countries and only 15% of that are consumed in the U.S. So in this context that it's basically, you know, using public resources and taxpayer dollars to feed China and wherever that fits into your international political ethic. You know, certainly environmentally, it makes me uncomfortable that we would be causing environmental destruction and slaughtering native predators in the U.S. in order to strike a better trade deal and make up the trade deficit with China.
Right. Well, you know, there's a whole lot more we could say about this issue, but we are out of time. So I want to thank you, Madeline Carey, for joining me on today's show. I'd also like to thank our audio engineer and Kuru Guru, Kyle Johnson. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning into this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM. This is what community radio looks like.